Thank you. As you can see, I've decided to recycle my transparencies from strings from Rome. And so the alternative title is Gravity at a Lifshitz Point, which hopefully adds a little bit of meat to the condensed matter people in the audience, because gravity with anisotropic scaling, what is that, right? So, but before I start with going through the transparencies from strings, I actually was inspired by David Gross's talk at Strings, where he gave this nice list of open questions, big philosophical questions in string theory that he raised in the Santa Barbara conference in 1985. So he was going all the way back and telling us which of the big questions have been answered and which have not been answered. I actually remembered that I gave a colloquium here in Santa Barbara five years ago, and it's somewhat relevant, so let me go over over the first two or three transparencies of that colloquium. So this is a follow-up to my paper from 2005 on some bizarre similarity between charged black holes in string theory, D-brains, and on one hand, and Fermi liquids, Fermi surfaces on the other. I think it's becoming more relevant now because we are discovering that there are some really deep connections. So when I was asked to give the colloquium based on that paper, which you see listed, I realized that I'm giving a colloquium about a field which doesn't exist, an interface between condensed matter and string theory. In 2005, there were very little papers, very few papers. So I wasn't sure, was that a colloquium about condensed matter or string theory or some bizarre mathematics of K-theory? And it reminded me of a science fiction book by Stanislaw Lem, a Polish science fiction writer, who wrote a book called The Perfect Vacuum, which is a collection of reviews of non-existent books that haven't been written yet. So it felt like that four or five years ago. It felt like that, giving a colloquium on condensed matter interfacing with string theory. Most of it hasn't been even invented at that time. None of it has been invented. So I would like to thank the organizers for collecting this group of people here, because now, as you can see from the evidence of this workshop, many of these books have been written, and they really look beautiful. So it's really great to be here and be a part of this workshop. So let me go back to the anisotropic gravity idea. As I said, this was these are transparencies from strings. So they're based on my work over the last three or almost 4 years. Most of it was published in the first four papers up there. And plus there is some work in progress with various students in Berkeley, mostly Charles Melby Thompson, who is here in the audience. So all the difficult questions should be addressed to him. And since those four papers in January or so, there's been a lot of follow-up work. This is only a partial list of people who wrote papers on this topic. So it seems to be popular, at least in some part of the physics community. And before I get to even the central idea of my approach to gravity, let me stress the big picture. I think the big picture here is that there are lots of beautiful new ideas in condensed matter, which are new, maybe not to condensed matter physicists, but certainly to string theorists and high energy physicists. Things like the idea of anisotropic scaling, which will be central to my talk. But many other ideas in condensed matter have not really made their way through to high energy physics yet. And I think it's foolish on the side of the high energy physics community to ignore these ideas. They will be eventually useful for various aspects of high energy physics. So in my opinion, the cross-pollination of these two fields should really go both ways. Most of the talks in this workshop applied string theory as an established subject to produce new ideas, new concepts, new structures in condensed matter. But you should ask yourself, is it possible it's going to go the other way also? And one of my arguments today is that there are signs that the ideology from condensed matter will be useful also for string theory. So we'll learn new things about string theory and quantum gravity from condensed matter, not just the other way around. Okay, so the basic idea of what I'll be talking about technically today is to combine the idea of gravity with the concept of anisotropic scaling. During various talks in this conference, we've always assumed implicitly or explicitly that there is only one gravity. Once you are settled on what kind of solution of Einstein's equations you're looking at, maybe it's some kind of a dual to some interesting CFT, maybe there are some matter fields. It was never questioned that the right equations of motion in the bulk start with terms that look like Einstein's equations. Perhaps there are higher order corrections, but this is all calculable from conventional string theory. Now, it's not clear to me that that should always be the case. And in particular, conventional general relativity being relativistic seems at first incompatible with the idea of an isotropic scaling between space and time. So let me start first by introducing this possibility that I'll introduce a space-time manifold, which will be a fixed topology manifold. I'm not putting any geometry on it yet. But even before I put in any geometry, any fields, any metric, or any other objects, I already have a differentiable structure, and I'll declare that the differentiable structure is such that there are preferred coordinates which scale anisotropically. So I'll be kind of fishing for an anisotropic Gaussian non-interacting fixed point describing the metric field. And then I'll ask whether, once we find that anisotropic Gaussian theory, can we perturb it to make it an interacting theory? And at least at the classical level, you'll see that surprisingly the answers are yes to both questions. So the idea, again, is to introduce the dynamical critical exponent. To this audience, I don't have to explain what that means. So David Gross missed my David Gross-oriented joke at the beginning of the... So we'll study values of Z which are not necessarily equal to 1. And everybody here knows that in condensed matter, many interesting systems have not only Z equal to 1 or 2, but you can have all kinds of fractional values. And they typically occur in critical systems, quantum critical systems, or historically they were preceded by non-trivial values of Z occurring in dynamical critical phenomena. So I don't have to explain the background. What I do have to explain is why am I even interested in some such set of new gravity concepts? Well, if they exist, they should be interesting. So that's, of course, one justification. But more importantly, why should we not be happy with the status of string theory as it is right now? What's missing in string theory? Why would we even bother trying to develop some extension of it? Strings, of course, represent a beautiful theory of quantum gravity, but I would like to argue that string theory is in some sense too large and also in some other sense too small. It's too large because it contains apparently way too many vacua if you believe in the preliminary results about the landscape of non-supersymmetric vacua. And as such, it represents a huge machinery. If you want to understand some relatively simple question from quantum gravity, do you have to use all of this machinery with all this huge landscape of vacua to answer the simplest possible questions in quantum gravity? Or can you? Are we lucky, and is there a smaller theory of quantum gravity? Just like we are lucky with the existence of QCD, in order to answer questions in QCD, you don't have to embed it into string theory and then solve some complicated string theory situation. So Yandell's stage theories are UV complete by themselves. And the question is quantum gravity possibly like that? Perhaps if we combine it with some new concepts originating from condensed matter. So in that sense, I would say we are fishing for a smaller theory of quantum gravity than the entire string theory. Also, string theory, in my view, is a little bit too small because we've been very successful realizing lots and lots of static or stationary, highly supersymmetric or less supersymmetric solutions of string theory. String theory is very good at static and stationary and supersymmetric things. But string theory is not very good at cosmology. It's not very good at situations which are very far from equilibrium. And perhaps that's a sign of something. There's something missing that we should be trying to discover. Some extension of string theory which will be better at addressing time-dependent questions than cosmological questions. So again, the idea of anisotropic scaling having originated in time-dependent systems in condensed matter might be one of the missing ingredients. Another motivation to abandon the idea of Lorentz symmetry is that in string theory, we've learned that the battle between quantum mechanics and the symmetries of general relativity, which dominated the 20th century physics, was at least tentatively won by quantum mechanics. We are not modifying quantum mechanics one bit. We are modifying diffeomorphism invariants and the ideas of smooth space-times. we are discovering that smooth space-time is often an emergent concept, or at least space, if not space-time. And if space is emergent, then it's very difficult to imagine that Lorentz symmetry would somehow be a fundamental underlying symmetry of all of string theory. If space is emergent, then Lorentz symmetry, almost by definition, would also have to be emergent. So I'm agnostic on the emergence of Lorentz invariants, but at least the idea is, if you see signs that it might be emergent, then you should not consider it as a fundamental symmetry. So that's another reason why I'll be trying to build a theory of a metric fluctuating field as a conventional quantum field theory in the path integral formalism without the idea of ultraviolet Lorentz invariants. So again, I'm hoping that this is going to end up being relevant for problems of strings and quantum gravity out of equilibrium. This is not supposed to be an alternative theory of quantum gravity as an alternative to string theory, but you would want to see it instead engineered or embedded into engineered from string theory or embedded into string theory, just like Yang-Mills gauge theory. So what are the possible applications if we are successful with this program and there is some kind of a gravity with anisotropic scaling? Then until about 25 years ago, the only possible application of gravity you could think of would be our universe, the gravity as we observe it in 3 plus 1 dimensions with all the observable checks that verify that general relativity is a good description at low energy. But since then, there are at least 3 additional applications, and perhaps they are equally valuable. So I wouldn't necessarily obsess too much about application number 1. Applications number 2, 3, and 4 are really valid points. For example, we have learned that quantum gravity can reside on fluctuating world volumes of brains. In particular, what I have in mind is that the string orchid itself is a two-dimensional quantum gravity system, actually with local conformal invariants, if you look at critical strings. So if you develop some alternative theory of gravity, you can imagine putting it on some other brain, perhaps in a different dimension. We'll see an example of that happening once we go to values of z equal to 2. That will be a quantum gravity theory which is suitable to reside on a 2 plus 1 dimensional membrane world volume. And of course, for the purpose of this workshop, perhaps the most exciting application is number 3. If you have an alternative gravity system, then perhaps that enhances the number of CFT duals. If your bulk gravity has a solution which has an interesting boundary where you can put some interesting CFT, maybe the idea of CFT correspondence should be really extended to a broader class of gravity models. Who are we to believe that whenever you have an interesting non-relativistic CFT on the boundary, the bulk gravity will always be Einstein's general relativity with z equal to 1. Wouldn't it be natural to expect some kind of anisotropy to be possible on both sides of the duality? That was actually probably the main motivation for this program 3 years ago. And of course, mathematical applications shouldn't be ignored. You can think of various topological versions of quantum gravity models, and they could be relevant to things like the Ricci flow problem, as I will be mentioning in a few minutes. All right, so in order to motivate the construction, I could just write down some kind of a bizarre gravity Lagrangian, but I'll try to motivate it by reminding you something that we've heard from several talks. Michael's talk in particular, where he talked about Lifshitz ADS CFT. So he was reviewing the Lifshitz scalar theory, and I'll do the same very quickly as a kind of warm-up exercise, because what I want to repeat is to look at the structure of scalar fields with anisotropic scaling and how they're related to known relativistic or Euclidean field theories. And then I'll try to do the same for gravity, to develop using the same scaffolding, I'll try to develop the same kind of new theory in a higher dimension. So in string theory, when I teach my string theory class, I usually point out that strings are special compared to other brains for a very good reason. And that reason actually is a list of about 4 different coincidences which pick out 1 plus 1 dimensions as special. And 2 of those coincidences are listed here. The list goes on, but those 2 are the most important ones for our purposes. The first one is that if you write down the simplest scalar field theory in the Euclidean signature on a Euclidean world volume in d dimensions, then of course 1 plus 1 d equal to 2 is the critical, the lower critical dimension of the scalar field. That's where the scalar field is dimensionless, and that's very important because that gives you classically an infinite collection of classically marginal deformations of this simple scalar field theory. And we know where that led, because when Dan Friedan in the 80s calculated the beta function for this infinite hierarchy of couplings, he realized that they were giving him Einstein's equations plus corrections. That's one of the most elegant ways of deriving Einstein's equations from quantum physics. And of course, that's special to being in two dimensions. If you are in any other dimension, boring things happen. So 1 plus 1 is special for that reason. And another reason why 1 plus 1 is special, this scalar field theory can be coupled consistently to two-dimensional gravity, because two-dimensional gravity is also, in a sense, in two dimensions at a critical dimension. That's where the formal Newton constant would be formally dimensionless. So there's something special about gravity that also picks out two dimensions. And these two things conspire to give you the string worksheet physics. And what I would like to ask is whether we can shift the dimension by playing with the theory. Can we get something interesting that picks out other dimensions than 1 plus 1 plus 1? And of course, condensed matter people will not be surprised that if you have a theory with a non-trivial value of the dynamical critical exponent, the critical dimensions will shift. But to high energy physicists, including myself, that's a relatively new concept. All right, so a quick review of the Lipschitz scalar. The Lipschitz scalar field theory in the simplest incarnation is described by this action written down in here in yellow. And it can be constructed by a nice trick, starting from the action that I described by W. I call that W for a reason, because I want to compare the action from the previous transparency, which is a relativistic Euclidean signature action, to a new theory in one higher dimension. Now d plus one dimensions, we are adding an extra time dimension. Build a new theory by essentially mandating that the ground state wave function of this new theory be given by the exponential of minus the action of the lower dimensional theory. This is very closely connected to the idea of detailed balance in condensed matter. I don't want to go into the details, but technically the idea is, if you write down a theory in d plus one dimensions, which is anisotropic between time and space, you have two derivatives along the time direction competing against four derivatives in the spatial direction. Delta here is the spatial Laplacian. So you have z equal to 2, because the time dimension is essentially worth two spatial dimensions as far as the scaling goes. And this theory has a calculable ground state wave function, because the ground state wave function satisfies this simple equation. The variation of the ground state wave function with respect to phi is equal to the equation of motion that comes from varying w times psi. So this will be satisfied identically. I think I don't have to explain this in detail, because it's either known to the condensed matter people, or it has been seen by string theorists who have seen my previous talks, or in any case, this is just a small technical detail helpful in the construction of the theory, but it's not crucial for the construction. The novelty here is, compared to the relativistic case, if you calculate the dimension of the field phi near the Gaussian theory here, then of course it comes out to be d minus 2 over 2, where d is now the spatial dimension. So the critical dimension is 2 plus 1. And because z is equal to 2, we see this nice shift in the critical dimension. The system now has a lower critical dimension, 2 plus 1, and we will see yeah. Well, it is used as a mathematical condition. You can use it in quantum critical systems as well, right? You can say, let me build a quantum critical system whose ground state wave function is related to the universality class. And you can, whatever we want to call that condition, I don't. Okay, sure. The detailed balance to me is just words for now. It's not meant to imply the context of non-equilibrium. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's a motivation which I could have skipped. I could have written down just the action directly in d plus one dimensions and never mentioned the condition of detailed balance. Sorry? No, not necessarily. No, I think it's an exception whenever it works. I don't know if this is known, where there are conditions. People have tried, even in two dimensions, looking at other let's say, WCW models, and it's very difficult to make it work for generic systems or for fermions, free fermions in two dimensions. Again, it's a complicated story. So for the scalar, it works, and there's probably a non-systematic set of other examples, but it doesn't seem to be a rich set of theories for which this can be done. Eduardo will be the best person to talk about. But only sometimes, right? Right. But they had to work very hard, and it didn't work in the same straightforward way. When they tried the WZW model, it really... Okay. Right. The Rux Arkivoson point in the dimer model is in the same universality class of this one. Sure, yeah. In any case, this is a fascinating discussion in principle, but I think it's very tangential to what I'm trying to do, because in the end, it actually turns out that even though I'll be using the same mathematical trick to get a hold of an interesting action in D plus one dimensions for gravity, it'll no longer have a ground state wave function that's calculable, for the same reason for which QCD does not have a simple ground state wave function. QCD, coincidentally, also satisfies the detailed balance condition. It is related in the same way to a lower dimensional, three-dimensional theory of a gauge field, namely the Chern-Simons gauge theory. And e to the minus the Chern-Simons action formally solves the Schrödinger equation, but it's an unphysical solution. So the same thing will happen for gravity. So we'll even lose the connection to a possible ground state wave function, which is fine, because if the theory is interesting, it's going to have a much more complicated ground state wave function, just like QCD has a much more interesting ground state wave function. Absolutely. Yeah. So there's a, you could call it a species problem. If what you were interested in would be a flow to z equal to one generically, not only z equal to one, but to a relativistic theory, then if you have fields that are not related by an extra symmetry, you have to invent some new mechanism, and that has not been invented yet. So what I'll be talking about mostly is free gravity without matter field, free in the sense of self-interacting gravity without matter, because that's the simple. If you have two scalar fields, for example, then each of them can have their separate speed of light, basically, coming out of the relevant deformations. So this is the story I wanted to at least briefly discuss. Again, it was discussed in previous talks, so very quickly. This Gaussian anisotropic z equal to 2 theory has free field relevant deformations, so you can actually follow through with the flow from the UV to the IR in this exactly solvable model. And if you put in a relevant deformation that depends on the spatial derivatives of the scalar squared, then of course this mu wants to be interpreted as a rescaling of time. So you absorb mu into the rescaling of time. Mu plays the role of the speed of light. And for the single species of a scalar field, the theory developed not only a natural z equal to 1 scaling in the infrared, which would be generic, but also an accidental Lorentz invariance on top of that, which means that there's only one speed of light. If you had more species, then they might get different mu's here, and therefore they might not share the same speed of light. You still get the same scaling z equal to 1. That's my main point here, that the generic flows of these theories is from some exotic value of z, always generically z equal to 1 in the infrared, which might not necessarily imply Lorentz invariance. But it's still an interesting behavior. So in the historical context, these models with anisotropic scaling came out of, I guess it can be traced back to Lifshitz's work from 1941, which is actually much more generic, because he was considering a generic lattice, not just things in the continuum. But if I oversimplify what he was studying, it's essentially an attempt to fine-tune another coefficient. If you look at this action here, and look at how you would construct multi-critical points in the conventional sense, and you would have terms in the Lagrangian, in the potential here, and you would tune multiple coupling constants to find the multi-critical point, what Lipschitz suggested was, why not do the same, not just in terms with terms in the potential, but also with terms that depend on the spatial derivative. So he tuned mu in addition to m to zero in this notation, and he got a tricritical point dominated by this anisotropic scaling. And of course, it's a tricritical point that connects three different phases. Either you have a zero condensate phase, or a constant condensate, or you can have a spatially modulated phase. And I'm mentioning this because I'll be actually raising a similar question about gravity. In the case of gravity, we'll be able to find a Lagrangian, which kind of replaces this central point, the multi-critical point, and it's going to be interesting to ask whether, for example, there is a spatially modulated phase of gravity. That's going to be relevant for a reason which I'll explain. You can also generalize Lipschitz's approach, as he did originally, to a more complicated setup where you have various groups of dimensions, each of them scaling with a different value of z, dominated by a different power of the derivatives on the potential. You can easily see that this is essentially, if you allow for an arbitrarily high dimension, this is an infinite kind of sequence of models. And I'm mostly talking about the simplest case where I split only time versus space and consider space isotropic. But towards the end, we'll actually see interesting new examples of gravity models which are even spatially anisotropic. So this is relevant for things which are not that disconnected from ADS-CFT because, for example, we believe that a really nice, interesting interpretation of the Schrödinger space itself, the ABS dual of Schrödinger field theories, is in terms of these nested kind of multi-critical Lipschitz systems. More about that towards the end. All right, so let's jump to the gravitational construction. So we want to repeat the same for gravity. We want to write down a theory for the spatial components of the metric. So I and J go over spatial indices. And the simplest kinetic term one can write down is something like the analog of the phi dot squared. The dot, of course, is the time derivative. I didn't say that explicitly, but maybe I should have. You want to contract two time derivatives of the metric using some covariant object. And the candidate for that is the so-called DeWitt metric, where lambda is an arbitrary coupling constant unrestricted by the symmetries, unless you impose additional gauge symmetries. If you impose the additional gauge invariance that reproduces general relativity. In other words, you would want to write down a theory which is space-time diffeomorphism invariant, then lambda would be forced to be equal to 1. But we'll have a theory which has fewer gauge symmetries, only space foliation preserving diffeomorphisms. And in that theory, lambda can be an arbitrary coupling. And then, mimicking the construction of the Lipschitz scalar, I want to add a potential term which is essentially the square of the equation of motion of some lower dimensional relativistic theory described by an action W. Now, this is a simplification. I could have just said, I postulate my value of Z, I declare what the scaling dimensions are of various fields, and let me just write down the most general Lagrangian compatible with gauge symmetries. That will relax this special form of this potential piece. It will still lead to the same kinetic term. The kinetic term here is generic, but the potential term here is not the most generic one that you can write down in a way compatible with foliation-preserving diffeomorphism. So again, borrowing imprecisely the terminology from condensed matter, if the potential term has this special form, I'll say that the theory satisfies the detailed balance condition, even though the terminology might rub some of the condensed matter theories the wrong way. And it's very easy to abandon that condition and just write down the most generic thing as any effective quantum field theories would. All right, so that theory that I wrote down on the previous transparency might be a good starting point, but it still doesn't really represent the most interesting case. It doesn't, in some sense, it doesn't have enough gauge symmetry. You can actually check that it's only invariant under time-independent spatial reparametrization. So that's a very small gauge symmetry compared to general relativity. So in order to get a theory which has bigger gauge symmetries, I actually restore all the missing components of the full d plus one dimensional metric and write them in the so-called ADM decomposition into the so-called lapse function, the shift vector. And I'll use these variables. In some sense, they will represent the gauge fields for making the spatial diffeomorphisms time-dependent. The gauge field corresponding to that is Ni, and making time reparametrizations possible as a gauge symmetry. This function N is essentially a gauge field for that. But as it turns out, if you replace G dot everywhere by the extrinsic curvature of the preferred spatial foliation of spacetime, the extrinsic curvature is given by this expression. It's just a covariantized version of G dot. And then if you replace the volume element everywhere by n times the square root of G, G being the spacetime determinant of the spacetime of the spatial metric, then the previous Lagrangian becomes covariantized, and it's becoming invariant under the so-called foliation-preserving diffeomorphisms. You can arbitrarily, even in a time-dependent way, reparameterize space, but the time dimension can be only reparameterized as a function of time, not of space. Else are the symmetries preserving a preferred slicing of space-time. Sure. Right, right. The lesson that I'm generalizing is that what you describe is essentially what high energy physicists would recognize as the stochastic quantization approach to quantizing a lower dimensional system, figuring out the partition function by having lattice simulation run in some imaginary time. And the lesson is, in quantized matter, you guys figured out that if you take that imaginary time and analytically continue it back and declare it to be the real time, you can sometimes get that theory to really describe a physical quantum mechanical system in D plus one dimensions. So the idea is to do the same here for gravity, basically. So I'm really interested in the theory in D plus one dimensions. I'm not trying to develop it as a tool for calculating some partition function of that relativistic or Euclidean signature theory in lower dimension. I'm really after some new class of models in D plus one dimensions. Once you find out the Lagrangian, like we have here, you can forget the connection completely to the lower dimensional model and just say this is an interesting new Lagrangian in D plus one dimensions, which happens to, in the free field limit, describe some free system with Z not equal to one. And the fluctuations in the path integral are those of a metric field. So in that sense, you're supposed to think of this in terms of a quantum field theory defined in the path integral framework. No, not, absolutely not. Yeah, exactly. You are interested in D plus one dimensions at all times, unless you are interested in taking this D plus one dimensional theory and finding some new ideas like solution, and then trying to see whether there's an interesting CFD on the boundary of that solution. That's another possibility, how to get some insight into a lower dimensional associated system. But it would not be, of course, related to that gravity in D dimensions that I started with to construct this Lagrangian. So let's see. Since I only have limited amounts of time, I should get to discussing some examples. So if you take the lower dimensional theory to be just the conventional Einstein-Hilbert action, here I'm ignoring the cosmological constant for now because I'm at first interested in the possible UV physics. And then, of course, the cosmological constant can always be added as a relevant deformation. We'll study the relevant deformations in a second. Right now, we are just trying to identify the leading term. If you take this as your seed action in D dimensions and plug it into the formalism, it spits out something like this, where these are now the covariantized time derivatives. The kinetic term, again, contains this arbitrary coupling constant, lambda. Classically, you can actually look at this model and linearize it near the z equal to 2 fixed point. By the way, this is a z equal to 2 theory because here you are squaring Einstein's equations. There are two spatial derivatives here. They're being squared, so you have four spatial derivatives on the same footing as two time derivatives. And that means that the dimension of the coupling constant here is 2 minus d. By the way, this means also that you have shifted, just like in the case of the scalar field, when you get to the z equal to 2 version of gravity, the critical dimension where the analog of the Newton constant is dimensionless is now 2 plus 1. So that's the phenomenon I was advertising earlier, that this theory might be a good candidate for a theory on a 2 plus 1 dimensional world volume of a membrane of some sort. Yeah. that W will not be a ground state wave function because, as we know, in Euclidean gravity, this is not an action which would be bounded from below. So you would get a non-normalizable solution of the Schrödinger equation. As I keep saying, I could have skipped completely the discussion of W. I could have written down this action and say, look at this as an interesting gravity action in D plus one dimension. Just like for writing down. Well, in principle, yes, but of course, that's an ambitious project. What you can check here is that this is power counting renormalizable if you add generically all possible terms that are compatible with defoliation preserving diffeomorphisms. There aren't too many of such terms, so you have a candidate for a Gaussian fixed point near which the theory is power counting renormalizable. In this case, and this was of course checked already in the first paper that I wrote about this, if you look at the spectrum at the Gaussian, at the three field theory, you get normal polarizations of the graviton that you would normally get with the non-relativistic dispersion relation, plus you get an extra scalar which is essentially the volume factor of the spatial metric, and that would normally go away in GR because you would have locally one extra gate symmetry, that's the space-time dependent time diffeomorphism. There are various tricks how you can reintroduce an extra gauge symmetry. It would not promote the full symmetry into full space-time diffeomorphisms, but it would have the same number of local space-time gauge symmetries, and I'll comment on that later. That gauge symmetry might be designed to eliminate the extra scalar field if what you were interested in were a theory of gravity which has the same number of physical polarizations as GR. But as I keep saying, that's not necessarily the only motivation for the construction. So the detailed balance, or what I call the detailed balance condition for simplicity, it's again only a technical tool. I'm not particularly attached to it, but it might have some conceptual role. Let's not get into the details of this. Mathematical applications are, again, not particularly interesting to this audience. I don't see David Morrison here. So there is a connection to Ricci flow equations. In some sense, you can think of this theory as a natural quantum field theory for the Ricci flow relevant to the von Kreyk conjecture. The more interesting applications would be on low volumes of membranes. As I said, the z equal to 2 gravity model would be at a critical dimension in 2 plus 1. You can try to couple it to a bunch of Lipschitz scalar fields, for example, and see whether the theory there is related to the conventional relativistic path integral on vortices of strings. And there, in that 2 plus 1 dimensional case, we do establish, you can actually see that because gravity in two dimensions is so simple, you can actually reproduce the ground state wave function of this 2 plus 1 dimensional membrane and see that it matches the Polyakov path integral in two dimensional string theory. So that's a story which again is tangential to the things that are of most interest to the ADS CFT community. So one concept I wanted to develop along the way is the idea of anisotropic Weyl symmetries. Just like in the case of conventional relativistic gravity, you can try to gauge conformal symmetries, and that's crucial on worksheets of critical strings. We not only gauge diffeomorphisms, but also local conformal transformations, which in our community are called the Weyl transformations. And it is kind of interesting that even in the case of gravity with anisotropic scaling, with some generic value of z, there is a way of extending the idea of Weyl transformations to the idea or concept of anisotropic Weyl transformations. There's a local set of symmetries given by this prescription. Notice the z exponent playing a role here in the Laplace function. The z shows up here, but the scaling of ni and gij is as if the theory were conventional relativistic. And it was a surprise to me that these local symmetries actually form a closed algebra with the infinitesimal foliation preserving diffeomorphisms. And that will play an important role a little later, hopefully, if I get there. So the original reason why this was interesting was for the matching between the 2 plus 1 dimensional path integral and 2 dimensional Polyakov type path integral of strings, because there you know that you have to reproduce the correct gauge symmetries. So for example, in 2+1 dimensions, if you scale n as e to the 2 omega times n, n, by the way, is the square root of g00, essentially, of the metric, then you get a theory which for some fixed value of lambda, namely lambda is now fixed to be 1 over d if you're in d spatial dimensions, exhibits local Weyl symmetries under this anisotropic Weyl transformation group. So you could play with various other values of z. Z equal to 3 will be power counting normalizable in 3+1 dimensions, and there is a natural way of getting a theory with z equal to 3. If you start in 3 dimensions with the Chern-Simons gravitational action, gamma is the Christoffel symbol here, treated as a functional of g. If you vary the metric in the Chern-Simons action, you get the equations of motion to be the Cotton tensor equal to 0. The Cotton tensor is defined here. And the Cotton tensor is a beautiful and important geometrical object which plays an important role in physics as well as math. The vanishing of C is the condition of conformal flatness in 3 dimensions, so it replaces the Weyl tensor as the test for conformal flatness of things. Also, it plays an important role in the initial value problem in general relativity. That's why it's sometimes called the ADM Cotton-York tensor, because ADM as well as York studied the initial value problem and the relevance of this tensor for the initial value problem. And interestingly enough, it's a conformal tensor. It transforms with a fixed conformal weight, unlike the curvature itself or any combination other than the Cotton tensor. So it has some accidental conformal properties. That was not necessarily something that you would put in by hand. This comes out that the natural z equal to 3 tensor that comes out from varying a 3-dimensional action automatically has this conformal type of behavior. So in all these cases, if you start by writing down some hypothetical UV free theory, you can deform it to an interacting theory, but then you want to ask what is the set of all possible relevant deformations compatible with the symmetries. And generically, you can deform the theory in several different ways. You can try to preserve this relationship with the lower dimensional action W and deform the lower dimensional action and see what kind of deformations that implies for the action in d+1 dimensions. And generically, if you do that, you discover that the terms that you get to be the most dominant ones in the infrared will always be the d-dimensional scalar curvature and some kind of a constant. It just happens that if you look at the conventional general relativity written in the ADM formalism, it would have the same form, of course, with a few discrepancies. It would have the same form, meaning that the kinetic term would look the same. This coupling constant lambda would be frozen to be 1 by the extra diffeomorphism symmetry. And this thing that I call the spatial potential accidentally has the same form. It's the spatial scalar curvature and a constant, the cosmological constant. So here, you recover, at least at the level of what comes up in the action, you recover the same qualitative structure as in general relativity, the two discrepancies being that in this case here, this constant lambda can be arbitrary in principle. More precisely, if you want the UV fixed point to be free of ghosts or tachyons, then you have to stay away from a small window between lambda equal to 1 over d and lambda equal to 1. But outside of that window, the spectrum is fine. And of course, the spectrum here contains one extra scalar field compared to conventional GR because we have one fewer gauge symmetry. Yeah? I don't have a proof that that's the case, but in situations, in non-gravitational models, it often is the case that this is stable under normalization. That's, to me, the main motivation for even coming up with this condition, because I'm hoping that it's going to restrict the number of independent coupling constants in the action. I'm perfectly happy writing down the most general theory, which does not come from a 3-dimensional action. In that case, you would have to write down any term here that's compatible with foliation-preserving diffeomorphisms and the value of z equal to 3. And you would have probably something like 7 marginal coupling constants plus a bunch of relevant couplings. And I challenge anyone to calculate the flow of the data of the coupling constants in that space. Exactly. Right. Yeah, precisely. The stochastic quantization method shows you that this is often, has never really been applied properly to gravity, in my opinion. So we don't know about what happens when you combine stochastic quantization methods with diffeomorphism invariance. But for non-gravitational systems, it's often the case that you just renormalize the couplings in the lower dimensional action, plus you have to perform one extra renormalization. Basically, the relationship between space and time gets an extra renormalization constant. But other than that, the potential terms are just are inherited from the renormalization of the lower dimensional action. We may or may not get renormalized. There is one renormalization constant that essentially sits at the... Yeah. Sure, yeah. In some cases, it definitely gets renormalized, sure. But of course, here I should say one thing which I haven't emphasized enough. The path integral language, right? So what a conventional quantum field theory person would do with a path integral, we go to imaginary time. The first thing you do, you try to calculate by analytic continuation. So you would go to the imaginary time picture where the Lipschitz, what I would call the Lipschitz action, is continued so that it looks like a Hamiltonian of the conventional Lipschitz system. Anyway, I think I should move faster because I wanted to get to some interesting new stuff. So, as I said, the RG flow will generically go to z equal to 1. Whether or not you end up close to GR or far from GR, that's an open question. But at least you reproduce the value of z equal to 1, which is interesting. And as I said, you can break that detail balance condition. So you can just insert, you can break it softly. You can assuming that the UV terms that satisfy the detail balance condition are self-contained under renormalization modulo generating relevant terms, you can just say, let me not impose the detail balance condition for the relevant deformations, and let me just add arbitrary ones. Be important if you want to unlock the values of the Newton constant and the cosmological constant from the speed of light. Maybe those are technical issues that are not of that much interest to the audience right now. Let me move on to another observation. There is a very interesting lattice model of quantum gravity in 3+1 dimensions that Ambjorn and company in Europe have been developing over the last 5 or 10 years. Actually, if you take the original work on two-dimensional lattice gravity as a part of this program, then they've been working on this for about 20 years. And finally, they are now getting very interesting results. For the first time, they are seeing a continuum four-dimensional limit of simulations. And that's at the cost of putting in one extra feature, one surprising, strange feature into the rules for the lattice simulation. So they're summing over random triangulations, or whatever the four-dimensional analog of triangles is. But they put in an extra rule. If they don't put that extra rule in, they would get phases which don't even have four macroscopic dimensions in the infrared, various branch polymer phases and so on. The extra rule is that there is a preferred foliation respected by the triangulation. So in that sense, they're putting in some relevant change of the usual rules for triangulations. And all of a sudden, after that change of the rules, they see that the spectral dimension of space-time is very nearly 4 in the infrared, which is great. For the first time in quantum gravity, we have a smooth four-dimensional space-time coming out of the lattice. But at shorter distances, still big enough to avoid lattice artifacts, but shorter than the infrared, they call it the UV, they see an effective dimensional reduction to 1.8 plus minus 0.2. So they say this effectively means that there is some effective reduction to two dimensions at short distances. Maybe the space-time is smooth at macroscopic distances, but at short distances, some kind of a form of two spheres. My favorite interpretation of this is that they are actually putting this type of anisotropic scaling of gravity model on the lattice. And the reason why they see the effective dimensional reduction at short distances has to do with calculating the spectral dimension of space-time in the presence of anisotropic scaling. There is a definition of the spectral dimension which asks you to put some auxiliary diffusion process on your space. And whatever the appropriate diffusion process is, you measure the return probability, take the log and stuff. And that gives you an effective measure of the dimension. If you do that on a space which has anisotropic scaling, where d spatial dimensions have z equal to z, you get, surprisingly enough, this type of number, which is effectively just dimensional analysis if you think about it. But if z is equal to 3 in the UV in three dimensions, this effectively means that the diffusion process sees effectively two dimensions as long as z is near 3. And then you flow in the infrared to z equal to 1, and this changes from 2 to 4, which is exactly the same type of behavior, a smooth kind of flow between 2 and 4 space-time dimensions. D over z. D over z, yeah, I guess, sorry. Typo. Nobody asked that string. Interesting. I think it's correct in the paper, but here, my big D is the number of spatial dimensions. So it should be 1 plus D over Z, because each spatial dimension essentially contributes 1 over Z. And the diffusion process is such that the time piece in the diffusion equation doesn't change. So you measure it in the units of time, basically. So that's why you get between 4 and 2. That's the natural definition of the spectral dimension. So you can go play games with z equal 4. That would be power counting renormalizable in 4 plus 1 dimensions. Maybe that's an interesting dimension for IDS CFT. Of course, the beauty in the case of z equal to 4, if you want to start with a detailed balance condition, there is a beautiful 4-dimensional Euclidean signature gravity theory with higher curvature terms. And there's this beautiful useless result sitting out there in the quantum field theory of higher power gravity models. Namely, this theory is known in the Euclidean signature. If you calculate the beta function for these couplings, it's known to be asymptotically free. That's a useless fact for interpreting the 4-dimensional theory as a quantum theory of gravity in 3 plus 1 dimensions, because if you rotate back to real time, of course you get into trouble because your theory will have ghosts. So you have an asymptotically free but inconsistent theory polluted by ghosts. Here you don't have to rotate. You use this W as the seed action for a 4 plus 1 dimensional construction. But if that, and this is of course a big if, as I keep saying, there is no proof that in gravity you would have this self-contained property under renormalization. So if this is stable under relative corrections, you would inherit the asymptotic freedom from this theory in 4 plus 1 dimensional gravity with z equal to 4. So one application to IDS CFT, which is immediate, if you have any theory which is built this way at the classical level, so assume now that you are looking at some gravitational bulk, and the theory is such that your action W in D dimensions satisfies only one very mild condition, namely it has a Euclidean ADS as a solution. That's a fairly decent condition. There's a huge robustness of classical models of gravity that you can write down by adding higher order corrections and curvature and so on. Many of these models will have ADSD as a solution. That's a very nice, robust feature. So assuming that we start with any such model, the good thing is that we don't have to specify here whether z is equal to 2, 3, or 4, or whatever. Then it turns out, because of the specific structure of the action, there is a geometry which looks like this. The lapse function is 1, the shift function is 0, and the spatial component of the metric. So essentially what I'm saying is G0, 0 is 1, the off-diagonal pieces of the metric vanish, and the spatial components of the metric are just the Euclidean ADS. This will be a solution of the theory in D plus 1 dimensions. And it's sort of the analog of the ground state solution. So it's the analog of ADS for these types of models. And of course, since the spatial slices are ADSD, this geometry has an interesting boundary. The spatial ADSD will have a D minus one dimensional sphere as the boundary. Plus, of course, this geometry sits there for all time, so have as D minus one cross time as the boundary. And the bulk isometries of this solution are precisely given by conformal symmetries of the D minus one dimensional sphere, the spatial sphere at the boundary, plus time translations. These are precisely the symmetries that you would want from a system. Essentially, again, this is connected to the fact that the system, the Lipschitz system, is related to a d-dimensional model, which is already critical in d dimensions. Here you have conformal symmetries of the spatial sphere. So this is a system that wants to be already critical in the spatial sense. Plus you are adding time translations. So you are adding the possibility of having correlation functions not only at fixed times, which would satisfy already the conditions of conformal invariance, but you can also calculate in principle correlation functions at different times. So it seems, again, this is very preliminary, but it seems that this type of a model would be a natural setting for hypothetical ideas or bulk duals of systems which are already critical as spatial systems, static systems. I'm virtually out of time, but I wanted to get to some new stuff. One comment on the case where you throw away completely the potential term, keeping only the constant. This is something that has already appeared in the literature under the name of ultralocal theory of gravity. The reason why I'm mentioning this theory is not just because it was already discovered in the 70s, but also, most importantly, because this theory, unlike what you would naively expect, it actually does develop the extra missing asymmetry automatically. This is a theory which is generally covariant, even though it is not space-time diffeomorphism invariant. What I mean by general covariance is there is a fourth, if you are in 3 plus 1 dimensions, there is a fourth gauge symmetry, which essentially acts as an abelian U1. And so you have spatial foliation-preserving diffeomorphisms plus an extra U1 gauge symmetry automatically being gauge symmetries of this system. So that number of symmetries locally at least matches that of GR in that symmetry. You can think of it as a linearized time diffeomorphism, actually. All right, so if you are interested, I can comment on trying to make these types of theories compatible with the general covariance defined on, as on the previous transparency. But maybe this is of more interest to string theorists than condensed matter people, so I'll skip most of it. Again, this is one possible way of keeping an extra subleading piece in the G00 component of the metric and keeping linearized time diffeomorphisms. This would be the same gauge symmetry that appeared in that ultralocal theory. And this nicely works in 2 plus 1 dimensions. We have difficulties with this setup in dimensions higher. And here, I would like to at least point out one possible new application, which is some work in progress with Charles. The idea is that even if you don't believe that there are anisotropic theories of quantum gravity, some new exotic corner in the quantum gravity universe, the concepts that we are developing here might actually be useful already for conventional GR. In particular, you guys have seen how interesting the Schrödinger spaces are, or the Lipschitz spaces are, because they are hypothetical bulk duals to interesting non-relativistic CFTs. It is still very confusing how to perform holographic renormalization in these spaces. And we think that inspired by the concept of anisotropic conformal invariance that we saw emerging from this anisotropic gravity setting, we can provide a new alternative definition of conformal boundary, which is much more aligned with what happens in the Schrödinger and Lipschitz spaces. Even though this doesn't force you to abandon conventional GR in the bulk, it has to do with the fact that the asymptotic boundary conditions really want to become non-relativistic and more like in a theory with anisotropic scaling. So let me jump to the punchline here. So this is, as you will recognize, the metric of the Schrödinger space. And the way we think of the Schrödinger space is essentially as a space which has a natural anisotropic scaling. That doesn't necessarily mean that we are embedding it as a solution into a gravity theory with anisotropic scaling, but there is a natural sense in which you think of T as of dimension 2 compared to X. So the natural scaling that this formula, the metric, suggests is to rescale T with Z equal to 2, rescale X, and not rescale theta. This theta is the dimension that some people, I think, call C. We call it theta. And this appears to scale not at all under these rescalings. If you think about it, the best way of understanding this case is to actually declare that theta scales with z equal to infinity. That's the relative scaling between t and theta. So we are saying the following. There is a natural anisotropic scaling in this background where spatial dimensions other than u will have z equal to 2. U ends up having z equal to 2, and theta has z equal to infinity. And it's interesting, one thing we tried to do is to was to extend this kind of Poincaré patch metric to a Schrödinger analog of the global coordinates of ABS, and that is possible if theta is a non-compact dimension. You can actually, for z equal to 2, you can actually see by this particular coordinate transformation that you can extend the Schrödinger space beyond the Poincaré patch. You get this interesting geometry. What's interesting is that if you look at the transformation of coordinates, it's actually preserving the double foliation structure. So in some sense, what I'm suggesting is that the natural interpretation of the Schrödinger space is as an example of a space with a double foliation, where you foliate first by slices of constant space, and then space is foliated by slices of constant x. So you have these three groups of coordinates, tau, all the spatial coordinates, and theta. And it turns out that this transformation of coordinates from the Poincaré patch to the global patch is a double foliation preserving diffeomorphism. All these facts, if you recall now what I was saying earlier, if you have a foliation preserving diffeomorphism group, and that's the relevant asymptotic symmetry here near the boundary of these Schrödinger spaces, in the global picture or in the Poincaré patch picture that was here on the previous transparency, it is natural to use those anisotropic conformal transformations. As I pointed out, they are compatible with foliation-preserving diffeomorphism. And you can, instead of using the Penrose definition of conformal boundary, you can now invent a new definition. You can say, let me scale the metric by an anisotropic conformal transformation, which is compatible with these values of the scaling coefficients for various dimensions. And that leads to a new definition of anisotropic conformal boundary. What that boils down to in this case, in the Poincaré patch, you rescale all these factors by u squared. You rescale this one by u to the 2z, because that's the scaling dimension of time in this case. And what happens is that if you use the Penrose definition of conformal boundary, the boundary would be a very sick one-dimensional line, because, of course, this is a geometry which is conformal to the PP wave. So the boundary geometry is as sick as in the PP wave. But if you use the anisotropic definition of conformal boundary, this will have a nice codimension one conformal boundary whose isometries, whose conformal symmetries will be those of the Schrödinger group. So it seems that even though we are not abandoning the idea that the deep in the bulk of the theory is described by conventional fluctuating GR with matter, the asymptotic boundary conditions of the Schrödinger space are such that they are asking for this new anisotropic definition of conformal boundary, which is much more aligned with what you expect from holographic renormalization. And I had one more thing, but since I'm relatively out of time, I think I'll skip this or mention this only very briefly and leave this for possible discussions. Another way of introducing anisotropic gravity models, which will now have anisotropies also between various spatial dimensions, is to recall how interesting it has been to study near horizon limits of various black holes in the history of string theory. If you look at the highly supersymmetric ones, of course, the entire ADS CFT wouldn't have been believed by anybody without the interpretation of this as a nice two duality descriptions of the near horizon limit in supersymmetric black brains. Recently, the near horizon limit of the Kerr geometry has attracted a lot of attention, and that leads to interesting results. So what if we try to apply the same idea of zooming in on the near horizon of the Schwarzschild, the simplest, the most robust, most elementary black hole that we have? So this is the Schwarzschild geometry, and you might be tempted to zoom in on the horizon, take a naive near horizon limit, which would take all these coefficients of the metric and keep always just the leading piece of each coefficient separately in the expansion in the near horizon coordinate. When you do that, you get this metric, and when you perform a slight change of coordinates, you realize that the first two pieces here give you a chunk of the flat Minkowski space, the so-called Rindler space. But the remaining dimensions become those of a round two sphere of a fixed radius. So you say, something is wrong. I've taken a really bizarre limit because the original solution was a solution of Einstein's equations in the vacuum, but the geometry after the limit does not satisfy Einstein's equations in the vacuum. And that's because, of course, the radius of the two sphere has been kept fixed. The usual way in which people take the near horizon limit of Schwarzschild is that they also scale the radius of the sphere while maintaining Einstein's equations throughout the scaling. And that leads essentially to decompactifying the two sphere. You get basically the Rindler space as a near horizon geometry. What we are suggesting here is something alternative. We can actually keep this way of defining the near horizon limit and get a flat space across a two sphere as a solution, but it's a solution of a scaled theory. So instead of scaling only the solution, we can also introduce a parameter into the theory. This parameter is, I'll call it C perpendicular. It's essentially the speed of light along the horizon of the black hole. And you can take an interesting scaling limit where you're taking the speed of light along the horizon to zero as you are taking this near horizon limit. And what you end up with, again, long story short, is similar to the scaling of Fermi liquids. Too bad I don't have the time to explain the connection in detail, but essentially you end up with a theory which has an isotropic scaling, but now the split is between two space-time dimensions, basically the radial plus the time. They'll scale the same way as a relativistic one plus one dimensional system, and all the dimensions on the horizon will scale a different way. In fact, what you get is naturally a limit where Z is equal to infinity along all these transverse dimensions along the horizon. And the theory will be power counting renormalizable. A cartoon of the Lagrangian for the theory would look something like this. You would have the full Einstein-Hilbert term, and you would subtract essentially the spatial part along the horizon, or the scalar curvature along the two dimensions of the horizon. So this is anisotropic. The split is between two plus two dimensions. The theory is power counting renormalizable. Again, if you assign the values equal to infinity to the angular dimensions along the horizon, the dimensional counting is such that the theory is power counting renormalizable. In some sense, it parallels the free theory of the Fermi, of a free Fermi liquid. If you look at the Landau theory of Fermi liquid from the RG point of view, because you're zooming in on the horizon, sorry, on the Fermi surface, I keep making this. There's probably a message in that. There's a close analogy between Fermi surfaces and horizons of black holes. So here you are zooming in Fermi surface, Fermi liquids, you're zooming in towards the Fermi surface. That changes the RG scaling compared to the naive scaling. If you quantize the same Lagrangian as a bosonic Lagrangian, you would scale towards the origin. The reason why the physics of Fermi liquids is so different and kind of so robust and independent of the dimension is that you're scaling towards the Fermi surface. So in the first approximation, you get a collection of 1 plus 1 dimensional fermions parameterized by where you are on the Fermi surface. And that's independent of how many dimensions you have in the Fermi surface in the simplest approximation. So something like that happens here in this gravity theory, that you're zooming in towards the horizon of the black hole. You get a collection essentially of 1 plus 1 dimensional gravities parameterized by where you are along the horizon. And this is a theory which is robustly power counting renormalizable independently of the dimension, just like the free approximation to the Fermi liquids. So again, I'm out of time, so this is just a list of some open future directions, and hopefully the future of this is going to be, again, connected to condensed matter applications. So in the future, I'm hoping that the flow of ideas will continue going both ways, not just from string theorists to condensed matter, producing new condensed matter universality features, but also from condensed matter to string theory, teaching us new lessons about quantum gravity and strings. Thank you. There could be some connection, although I've never been quite clear on how central that stochastic quantization connection was for the old triangulations. Here they really just changed the rules and put in this extra constraint by saying let's sum over triangulations which are only respecting this preferred foliation. And they're not invoking any stochastic quantization method at that point, in my opinion. Okay. Right, but that was really related to two-dimensional quantum gravity rather than higher-dimensional examples. For them, I think the precise reason why they put in the preferred foliation is to kill baby universes. And that was the early interpretation of getting a continuum limit, that you kill off, you don't get the branch polymer phase because you kill off baby universes, and that somehow changes the universality class to give you this continuum four-dimensional limit. Absolutely. They have to tune that. Exactly, yeah. Well, we had discussions of this. I actually flew to Copenhagen in April and I talked to Jan Ambjorn about this. And he explained to me how the numerics actually, how it works. Because they were saying, let's first start by triangulations where the size along the space dimension and the time dimension is the same, and they were getting garbage out of the simulation. And then they said, let's relax that, introduce another parameter, which is the relative size. And they had to tune that to get the continuum phase. It's not like it's just one phase. They have to really tune to a critical point where they get this behavior on one side of that four-dimensional continuum limit, where one of the dimensions is larger than the other. On one side, they get something which is completely correlated only in space, but not in time. And on the other side, they get the opposite, essentially. So my interpretation would be that it's basically a theory where you start with some crude latticization of something. You don't really know what the continuum action will be. You're hoping to get a continuum limit, so the theory zooms in on whatever fixed point it can find in the UV. And the reason why you have to tune these two different things is that in the continuum, you have to make sure that you end up with a Gaussian theory which has both the time derivatives and the spatial derivatives. So if you do the tuning incorrectly, you end up with a phase which would only have an action which has g dot squared, or you would have an action which only has the spatial derivatives on x on g squared. And the reason that you need to do the tuning between those two lengths of the triangles has to do with the fact that you have to match these two parts of the kinetic term in the UV. That would be my interpretation, that the theory would not have a continuum limit unless you correctly identify. You have to keep the relative coefficient of the two parts of the kinetic term in the continuum fixed as you take the continuum limit. But I don't know if that's the correct interpretation, because the results that they're getting, they're beautiful, but they only have very limited numbers of observables that they can measure. They can basically just measure the dimension, and they can measure crudely the size of the spatial extent of the universe, and that's all as far as I know. So it would really be nice to be able to see more observables and, for example, measure the number of local degrees of freedom in that system. Or they just have to tune the ratio. There's no way they can read off the value of z in some obvious way. My interpretation is that they see the value of z by seeing the spectral dimension. That's the observable that's sensitive to z. And the fact that they see that RG flow from 2 to 4, I think that is a check that this is a theory which has anisotropic scaling at the short distances, especially since that's, of course, allowed by the foliation. By allowing the foliation, not at the lattice scale, right? They have some ratio of the lattice sizes, and they tune that, and that's precise value of that tuning is, I think, it's a lattice artifact. You cannot use that as a measure of the value of z. Yeah. Sure. There are two different things, and they get often confused with each other. And one of them is that the debit metric itself has eigenvalues. And of course, on one side of some value of lambda, the one eigenvalue is negative, and on the other side, all the eigenvalues are positive. But that doesn't tell you about the physical spectrum, because the physical spectrum doesn't, you can't just look at the debit metric, you have to gauge fix. And that takes, basically, you define a slice through the space on which the debit metric acts. And the question, the physical question is, what are the eigenvalues on that smaller space of physical degrees of freedom? And as it turns out, that actually leads to positive spectra on both sides. Both for very negative and very positive lambda, you're fine. There's only that small window between 1 over d and 1, where there would be, a tachyonic mode. You never get ghosts, but you get a tachyon in that small window. But the issue of instabilities, actually, this reminds me, I wanted to mention the reason why there is the third question here, the spatially modulated phase of gravity. People often ask what happens when you start with, let's say, z equal 3 in the UV and add the relevant deformation that gives you the scalar curvature in the infrared. Now we have an extra degree of freedom. In the simplest realization of this model, you have that extra scalar. And as it turns out, if you get the correct kinetic term for the transverse traceless gravitons, you get the wrong sign for the scalar. And that, to me, is an interesting instability. That this theory suggests that there should be some kind of a spatially modulated phase for the scalar. Because remember, in the UV, the scalar still gets a kinetic term, which makes the theory stable. But it's precisely like in the Lifshitz scalar case, that the most dominant infrared part of the spatial piece of the kinetic term has the wrong sign, and the scalar wants to be spatially modulated. And it would be very interesting to just solve the classical equation of motion to see what kind of a ground state with spatial modulation you get. And the possibility is that if you start in 4 plus 1 dimensions, you will get a phase which is modulated along one dimension. It could still lead to some very interesting 3 plus 1 dimensional physics, some kind of an effective localization. But again, that's one of the open questions. That's why it's on this last answer. Okay.
The metric is dimensionless, less than the other.
Sure.
So, principle of infinite number of marginal operators? What do you mean?
There isn't, because you have diffeomorphism invariants.
Okay.
So, you cannot just write down arbitrary powers of the metric. You have to be covariant. So, you have to build terms from derivatives on the metric. There's only one scalar that you can make out of the metric without having derivatives, and then that's the cosmological constant term. And they're all irrelevant, with the exception of the ones that I've written down on in the transparency. Well, because yeah, exactly, yeah, exactly. Well, unfortunately, that few is like seven marginal ones. If you don't impose the, you can have things like R cubed or Rij, Rjk, Rkl, and they're all of dimension 6. And so there's like 7 different constants which are already classically marginal, plus you have to count all the relevant terms and see how the randomization flow goes, and that's forbiddingly complicated, at least to me.
John?
Well, again, there could be versions which are generally covariant, even though they're not space-time diffeomorphism invariant. Like the z equal to 0 theory that I was mentioning, it still has the analog of the Hamiltonian constraint. except that the, if you look at the gauge symmetry that it generates, it just generates a U1 gauge symmetry in the bulk. It doesn't generate honest nonlinear primary parametrizations. These are very interesting questions. I don't have answers to these questions. I'm just saying that in general, there could be ADS-CFT applications, but maybe not of the minimalistic setup here. Maybe you need to look at fancier versions of the theory, which have at least the right number of gauge symmetries that you would expect from GR, because that's what we expect from conventional ADS-CFT applications. But there are, of course, all kinds of different types of CFTs. It's not always just relativistic CFTs or Galilean invariant CFTs. There are conformal systems which come from condensed matter that have all kinds of exotic features. So the more exotic you get on the CFT side, at some point you'll have to probably get more exotic on the gravity side. My hope for the last 15 years has been that the answer is yes, but since that hope has already lasted for 15 years, I'm not so sure it's going to be so easy to find those theories if they exist. So this is very much what I would like. I mean, I would like it to be true that you can find all kinds of exotic non-relativistic backgrounds, intrinsically non-relativistic versions of string theory, but I don't know how to do it. So. Well, sure. Well, there are several layers of answers I could give. First of all, you can imagine, just if we start fantasizing about non-relativistic strings, you can have perhaps the scenario where you would have a conventional relativistic worksheet, but the theory in the target would be deeply non-relativistic. It would not come from some non-relativistic limit of a relativistic background. It kind of a sigma model which has highly non-relativistic properties to begin with. Or you can say maybe even the worksheet may want to get non-relativistic, but it's not necessarily what we are interested in. We are perhaps interested in space-time non-relativistic backgrounds. And I can in principle imagine that they could come from conventional relativistic worksheets, right? They don't have to come from making the worksheet theory non-relativistic. On the other hand, if you can make the worksheet theory non-relativistic, maybe that's interesting also. Sure, and you can interpret that fact, again, hypothetically, in some hypothetical set of non-relativistic worksheet theories. You could say, the fact that now I have a foliation on the worksheet, if I start interacting, I'll have preferred points on the worksheet. Maybe that's an advantage that will allow me to construct a bigger class of models. Just like in quantum field theory, you would lose the uniqueness of string theory, but we know that Feynman rules are consistent for particles that join in special points, and you can assign all kinds of group factors to it, and you have the richness of quantum field theory associated with the possibility of decorating Feynman diagrams by complicated group structures where the lines meet. And maybe there is a version of string. It's really hypothetical, but in principle, it's not. I don't see any obvious reason why it should be obvious. It's impossible to have a theory of strings where interesting things can be inserted where these leaves of the foliation join. No, in the minimal setting that I proposed in the paper, the elapsed function is only a function of time, and the constraint algebra closes in a very simple way. Now, if you try to naively say, let's keep the same gauge symmetries and let's make the elapsed function a function of time and space, you can try to do that, and of course that gets you into trouble with the closure of the constraint algebra. So, but that's not what I was suggesting in the first place. Right. Now you can try to close the algebra by force, and I know of one way of doing that. If you by hand allow n to be a function of everything, but you keep the same symmetries, you can actually go one step back and look at what happens when you try to commute to Hamiltonians to see the closure of the algebra. You get something which is quadratic in the variables that I called little a in the papers, which are essentially analogs of creation and annihilation operators for these metric fields. If you declare a and a dagger to be your constraints, then the algebra will close, but then these constraints will essentially want to be second-class constraints associated with a topological symmetry in the model. So this would be a scenario how to quantize, and it would lead to a topological theory. That would be a scenario where you can have n to be a function of time and space. If you want to have physical propagating degrees of freedom, then you want to, instead of just arbitrarily allowing the lapse function to be a function of time and space and have the same gauge symmetries as before, you have to invent a new extra gauge symmetry, which is what I would call general covariance here. So you have to have either an extra U1, which eliminates the extra degree of freedom, and at the same time allows you to close the constraint algebra. And that we know how to do in 2+1 dimensions, for example. In general, that might be a more difficult thing to accomplish. But the minimal theory, which has that extra scalar degree of freedom, has a perfectly fine closed constraint algebra, and n is only a function of time, not of space.